Okay, how are things going?
Good. Yeah.
Yay.
It's been a while.
It's been a while, I know. And in my other class, it's even longer since... It's going to be like 2 weeks that we didn't meet. Sounds good, right? That was a trick question. All right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. All right, so we're going to start. We were in the middle of talking about Pope. I assumed that you probably didn't bring the handout, even though you were supposed to, right? Yeah, okay. How many people actually brought it? Whoa, 2. Not bad. 20%. That's higher than inflation. Okay, so here this is again. We're going to... Still no one, huh? Oh, wait. Oh. Look at that. Okay. Okay. Yay, it's Alanish. And she's not on Bookface. Or maybe she is as well. Okay. Oh, she's still connecting to audio, so she didn't get my little joke. Oh, I was just making a joke about how you were probably on Bookface up until now. So, welcome to class. I guess, I don't know who you want to be not looking at. Here, you can just look at the whiteboard. That'll be good. I might write something down on it. Okay, if you notice anyone else trying to get in,
all
right. I'll glance from time to time as well. Okay, we are going to start talking about other forms next week, but I do want to finish talking about the Pope passage that we started last class, and which was how long ago now?
A week and a few days.
Wait, did we not meet at all last week?
We met last Tuesday.
We met last Tuesday, yeah, via Zoom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was when we met via Zoom, and now here we are in person. Okay, so thank you. So let's keep looking at the Pope passage. Then I want to talk about another line in Milton. And then I want to look at the poem by Thomas Wyatt, which is on the bottom left of the page, the poem sometimes called They Flee From Me. But this was an age, here's just a little interesting fact about the history of poetry, is that poems didn't tend to have titles before the 17th century, before the 1600s. So if you look at a poem, this is in English, this is in French, this is in lots of Western, this is true of a lot of Western European languages, probably true of most cultures, but I don't know for sure, but you can think of haiku, for example, which tend not to have titles. So this poem, the one whose first line is, "They flee from me that sometime did me seek," is often called They Flee From Me. When it was first published in, I'm just giving you this very quick background. When it was first published in a different version, in a cleaned up and edited and therefore inferior version in the mid-16th century, the publisher, a guy named Tottle, gave descriptive titles or descriptions, what we would call titles, but were really descriptions of the poem that you were about to read. And the description of this poem was, "The lover shows how he is abandoned by those that he loved." That appeared in a book called... the book itself has a very long title, but it is generally called Tottle's Miscellany. But it's all the long title contains within it, and it's usually thought of as songs and sonnets. It's actually songs and sonnets by, and then there's a list of the of some of the authors that it's by. The reason that I'm telling you that is that it's actually a book referred to in Shakespeare. A Shakespearean character says, who's about to go to war and he's afraid of what's going to happen, he says he would, rather than 50 pounds, he wishes that he had his copy of Songs and Sonnets with him. And the Grave Digger's song, one of the Grave Digger's song in Hamlet is, age with his stealing hands has clawed me in his clutch, which is a parody of one of the poems in Tottel's Miscellany. So this is a book that we know that Shakespeare liked and read. And that book is a cleaned up version. A lot of the poems in the book are cleaned up versions of the original poems, some by Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, who at the time was the more famous poet, and some by Thomas Wyatt. There were others as well, who was probably the first great poet in modern English. So we're going to look at this poem of Wyatt's. But before we do that, let's turn back to Pope. There are a couple of things that I want to say, still notice about how meter works and how Pope is thinking about meter working. And thing we were looking at last class had to do with the way there is always going to be an asymmetry in poetic form in most English poems written in most of the forms that English poetry is written in. This is not as true of French poetry. It's certainly true of other forms in other languages. In Latin and Greek, the asymmetry actually has to be introduced sometimes. That is, there have to be extra rules to make sure that you get an asymmetry. But it seems that asymmetry is really important to the effect of poetry, that symmetry means stasis. Symmetry means nothing is happening. Symmetry is, do people know what isometric exercises are? Is that a thing anyone is aware of? It's something that you can do if you're really bored and you can't get any exercise, and it's something they used to think was a really cool thing to do, but now they're bored even of that. Isometrics are, so you're sitting there, you want to get some exercise because your muscles are wasting away. So what do? You put your two hands together and you press as hard as you can. So it's like, if you're trembling, it means you're doing it. I wasn't actually doing it. I was just pretending to tremble. But if you press really hard, what's happening is your left arm and your right arm are both pushing really hard, and they're counteracting each other, so there's no movement. But you're still getting exercise. So the idea of isometric is the same measure. There's no motion because you're pushing in one direction, but pushing with the same strength in the other direction, and so there's no motion at all. So that's what happens if you have too much symmetry. Symmetry almost means the same thing as isometric. It means that things are just canceling each other out. It may be good exercise, but it's not good for the development, the progress, the arc, the motion, the trajectory of a poem. Whereas when you get asymmetry, when a poem is always having to adjust itself to, because it's always unbalanced, that's like running or walking. And that's why we said last time that the idea of feet, that poems are written in feet, the idea is that it's a kind of walking motion, that it's one foot, then the other foot, and it's going back and forth. And it's asymmetry that makes a poem go back and forth. So we talked about the asymmetry of a 5-foot line because it can't divide into two equal halves that look just like each other. In an iambic pentameter line, the first 5 syllables, that is the first 2.5 feet, are going to go roughly da-da, da-da, da. And the second 5 feet are going to go roughly da-da, da-da, da. So if you divide the line in half, you get 2 completely different forms. If you don't divide the line in half because you are thinking iambically, then it's going to go, the closest to symmetry is going to be a 3-2 or a 2-3 pattern. Da-da, 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 da-da. Or da-da, 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 da-da. But you can't divide the line in half. The same with sonnets, which is what we're going to turn to next. And I'm going to give you a couple of sonnets to bring in to read. Of course, you know, you're supposed to do your 9 hours of outside work for every week of class. So I know that you're reading nonstop and you've probably read Paradise Lost 4 or 5 times now in order to keep up with the reading requirement. We're going to look at sonnets and look at some of the asymmetries in sonnets, which we've already started talking about. The least asymmetrical form is the heroic couplet, which is why lots of people hate them. Lots of people do not like reading poetry, which is just couplet after couplet after couplet. What that means is that it's really hard to write well in heroic couplets just because of the way heroic couplets can fall into what feels like a boring symmetry. But that also means that if you can write well in heroic couplets, remember heroic couplets are where pretty much any rhyming pair of lines, any two lines that rhyme, can also stand alone. Pope, since we're looking at Pope right now, Pope has wrote wonderful epigrams also, which are essentially very short, funny little poems, often in simply a couplet. So Pope has a poem which is inscribed on the collar of the king's dog in his palace at Kew, and the poem simply goes, "I am His Majesty's dog at Kew. Pray tell me, sir, whose dog are you?" So there you get, it's funny, right, huh? Whose dog are you? There what you get is a heroic couplet. It's funny, it's symmetrical, but part of what makes it funny is that in the symmetry, there's a surprise that you think that, okay, you know how this is going to go. It's going to rhyme. It's going to be symmetrical. It's a couplet. It stands alone, and yet you're surprised. You may remember that very early on in this class, we looked at a poem in two lines, also a couplet, called "To Someone Who Once Suggested I Look Up Someone." Do you remember this? And the author, X.J. Kennedy, is actually, I think, thinking of Pope. And the two lines go, "I rang them," so it's to someone who suggested that I look up someone. "I rang them up while touring Timbuktu. Those bosom chums to whom you're known as who?" So they both are about a sudden pronoun, sudden unexpected pronoun, which nails the rhyme, but it's not what you were expecting. But doing something unexpected in heroic couplets, that's in a way the hardest thing you can do, and that's why there are so few really great poems in heroic couplets, or so few poets who write well in heroic couplets. But when they do, it's because they are really, really, really good at it. And Pope and Dryden are, in English poetry, the two people who are best at it. There are others who are really, really good, but I would say, you know, fewer than 20. Some of my colleagues would disagree. They would say fewer than one. But I would say fewer than 20. So at any rate, let's go back to the essay on criticism. And what we got to were the sure returns of still expected. Do you remember? While they ring round the same unvaried chimes with sure returns of still expected. Rhymes. Because what are you expecting? Rhymes. And sure enough, there it is, where air, you find the cooling western breeze, and the next line it whispers through the... Has to. Sure returns of still expected rhymes. If crystal streams with pleasing murmurs creep, the reader's threatened, not in vain, with sleep. So this is sometimes called a use-mention distinction. Do people know what that is? Philosophy majors, what's a use-mention distinction?
Difference between talking about those lines as lines versus invoking them as lines, sort of semantic versus syntactic.
Yeah, so when I was in sixth grade, or the kindly old senile principal of my school had to sub because our English teacher was away, and so he had a line, he had a routine, apparently, where he would say, so he said, so what are you working on? We said, parts of speech. He said, well, all words are nouns. And this is not what our English teacher had said. So we asked, what are we talking about? He said, give me a word. So someone said, okay, eat, which is what part of speech?
Verb,
thank you. Yes. And so he went to the board and he wrote on the board, E-A-T is a three-letter word. So that made it into a noun, right? Eat is a three-letter word. What he was doing was playing on the use-mention distinction, which is he was treating the word as an object, as the word that we were looking at, rather than as a word doing what words do in sentences. So... if you want to go eat, then you don't want to go noun, you want to go verb. You want to go verbing. But if you are looking at the word itself, then you are treating it as an object, as a word, rather than as what the word is doing. You may recall that this is like what Jakobson says about the poetic function of language, which is that it focuses on the message itself. So if you look at the word eat as a word, then you are focusing not on what it means, but on its actual existence as a word. So that's the use-mention distinction. It's a distinction that isn't hard and fast. It's a basic distinction. And, of course, philosophers have shown that you can't really draw a bright line between use and mention, but you can draw some line between them. So that's what Pope is doing. If crystal, and here's why the line isn't bright. If crystal streams with pleasing murmurs creep, the reader's threatened not in vain with sleep. That is, the reader's threatened with the word sleep. That is... what Pope is doing is mentioning a word that a crappy poet would use. Okay, does that make sense? So if crystal streams with pleasing murmurs creep, the reader's likely then to fall asleep. Something like that. In which case, you're not looking at the word sleep or asleep, you're looking at something that just makes sense in itself. But here it's the reader's mention not in vain with, quote, sleep, unquote. That is, the reader's threatened with the word sleep. Threatened not in vain, because it's always going to happen. Because whenever anyone says pleasing streams with crystal murmurs creep, they're always going to rhyme that with sleep. But also not in vain, because you're going to fall asleep before you get to that word. So you are threatened with the word, but you are also threatened with the state that the word indicates, that the word refers to, simultaneously with the word and with the state that it refers to. So that is an example of a blurring of the use-mention distinction. Anyhow, then at the last and only couplet fraught with some unmeaning thing they call a thought, A needless Alexandrine ends the song that, like a wounded snake, drags its slow length along. So someone remind us what an Alexandrine is. We talked about this line earlier this term, but what's an Alexandrine? Okay, see if you can figure out from the line. See if you can remember it. That like a wounded snake drags its slow length along. What do you notice about that line? Scan it. What's the form of the line? That like, just exaggerate it. That like, next. Here, everyone do it together. That like a wounded snake drags slow length along. So what do you notice about that? How good is the iam? How good is the iambicity of it? Yeah, so it remember, Lucan's had strict endings, but kind of halfway through, it gets to be a little hard. That like a wounded snake drags its, no, drags. So what happens on the word drags?
The word drag.
Yes, good. The word drag drags. So drags its. Okay, then we kind of fix it. Slow length along. Slow length, it could be slow length or it could be slow length. But you can force that into an iambic pattern. How many syllables in the line? Twelve, yes. So an Alexandrine is a French form. It goes back to a poem about Alexander the Great. We talked about this like a month ago. It goes back to a poem about Alexander the Great, a medieval French poem about Alexander the Great. So it came to be called the form or the verse of this poem about Alexander. So in French, it's Le Dard d'Alexandre. Can you say it better, Julian? Thank you. Ooh, yeah. And see, you should have come to the first month of class, but you can still pass. Then in English, it came to be known as an Alexandrine, and it's when occasionally you put in a 12-syllable line for variety, because that's something you do, is you try to vary things. If your name is Alexander Pope, do you notice that some mention of your name might seem relevant here? Easy question. Yeah. Especially since Pope himself, who was differently abled in many ways, often felt that he was dragging his slow length along like a wounded snake. So that's just a parenthetical footnote. So he says it's needless. You don't need this long line. So then he says, leave such to tune their own dull rhymes and know what's roundly smooth or languishingly slow. So how would you describe the word, the way the word languishingly moves in this line?
Slowly.
Slowly, languishingly slow. Yeah, it's just taking its time. Say it again.
It's drawn out.
Yeah, but in a way that is sheerly pleasurable. And praise the easy vigor of a line where denim strength and Waller sweetness jine is how he would have pronounced it. Remember, Pope's rhymes are always perfect. Denim and Waller were poets who we wouldn't love today. Denim is pretty good. But Pope thought they were pretty great. Then famous, well, all of this is famous. True ease in writing comes from art, not chance, as those move easiest who have learned to dance. So if you've learned to dance, you'll be graceful in everything that you do. 'Tis not enough, no harshness gives offense. the sound must seem an echo to the sense. So that is maybe the most famous line of the essay on criticism. The sound must seem an echo to the sense. If you ask people on the street about that line, you remember that line in Pope about sound and sense? Can you quote it? What you'll find is most people will say the sound must be an echo to the sense. Why is seem better? And why does seem to be remembered as be? All right, just the first question. Why is seem better than be? The sound must seem an echo to the sense. Okay, so good. It's like a sense. So the idea of the sound which we perceive through our senses, and the idea of sense which is different at the end of the line, because their sense means meaning. That is, this is senseless doesn't mean that my senses are unable to perceive it. It means there's no logic or meaning to it. And seem maybe is giving you, I think that's a really neat idea, that seem is maybe giving you an overlap between those two ideas of sense. If something seems to be in one way or another, it means we understand it. It has a sense for us in that way. But it's also sensation. Seem means how we see something. Seem is, people don't think of this as being so in English, but Pope did, and this was a more standard idea of what the word seem. Seem was taken to be the passive of see. So if you see something, it seems to you. It is seen, but it also seems to you. So the sound must seem an echo to the sense. What else is happening with the word seem? So we were talking about the sense of the word seem. What about the sound of the word seem?
The S.
The S, yeah. Why is that important?
Because the sound, the sense, the seem.
Yeah, because the alliteration, the sound must seem an echo to the sense. It's that alliteration that links sound and sense, or seems to link sound and sense. Good. So the sound must seem an echo to the sense. Soft is the strain when Zephyr gently blows. Zephyr is? No? Not a. So this is a word you need to know for any English poetry before 1900. Zephyr is a name for the west wind. Classical name for the west wind. Winds have different names. Zephyr is the nicest of all winds. The worst of all winds is the Scirocco. People were obsessed with winds. If you're from California, you know about Santa Ana winds. Santa Ana winds and Sciroccos are very similar to each other. They put people in really foul moods. This is actually been shown. They're full of positive ions is why. And they put people in really bad moods. Raymond Chandler says that lots of murders. He has Philip Marlowe, his detective, talk about how terrible the Santa Ana wind is and how many people pull out their kitchen knives and feel how sharp they are as they consider killing their husbands when the Santa Ana is blowing. So the Zephyr is the opposite of all that. We like the Zephyr. Soft is the strain when Zephyr gently blows, and the smooth stream in smoother numbers flows. How is the sound an echo of the sense there? Soft is the strain when Zephyr gently blows. What happens to the S sounds in that line? So we were looking at the alliteration. The sound must seem an echo to the sense. Soft is the strain when Zephyr gently blows. Do we get a continuation of that alliteration? How'd you like that for a rhyme? It's a terrible rhyme, continuation and alliteration. But does the alliteration continue? In what words? Okay, and then what happens? Yeah. Yeah, or maybe what happens is the S gets softer. Nice. Yeah. So soft is the strain. Strain there means what? Say it again.
Exertion.
That's what we think of strain as meaning. Don't do that or you'll strain your back. But what's the other meaning of the word strain?
Is it some sort of crop?
Some sort of
crop.
Crop? Is it?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm thinking of like straining pasta, like a pasta.
And so is Vivi. There's
like a thread.
Yeah.
Like a sort of, I don't know how else to, the thread's like a weird analogy for it, but like the sort of like. Strain of an idea.
Yeah, okay. So where it actually comes from, has anyone read Twelfth Night? So at the very beginning, the Duke Orsino in Twelfth Night begins, if music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it so the appetite should serve it. And then he says, famous line, picked up by T.S. Eliot, he says, that strain again. He wants to hear it again. That strain again. It had a dying fall. So that's a famous line in Twelfth Night. Strain there means, I think this is what you're thinking of, Elijah. It means a musical phrase. So a thread of music. So
some city, town, country lane, you'll hear him sing his plaintive little strain.
What's that?
That's the peanut vendor.
Oh, okay, yes. As I'm sure everyone knows. So strain can mean a bit of music. So for us, or what Pope is doing here is he's making us choose, as it were, between two meanings of the word strain. And one is the hard meaning, like, ugh, stress and strain. But then we realize, no, actually it's the other meaning. We now all realize that it's actually the other meaning of a lovely piece of music. Just a little portion of music that's lovely. I think they are connected in the idea of straining something through a colander or a sieve, which is that it's the lighter and the more beautiful part, not the hard part, that goes through it. So you leave all that damn pulp of the orange in the sieve, and now you get the refined orange juice. So that's what's strained. But it's not strain as in, oh, this is so hard. It's strain as in, oh, this is so refined. Strain is close to being a contronym. Do people know what contronyms are? It's when the same word means its own antonym. So anyone know any contronyms? There's some famous ones in English. Cleave, do you know about that? So to cleave, you can cleave two things apart. That is, separate them with a cleaver, boom, especially if the Santa Ana is blowing. Or, thou shalt cleave to the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might. That is, hang on as tightly as you can.
Raise.
What?
Raise and raise.
Yeah, but those are spelled differently.
Same spelling, okay.
Yeah, it's same spelling. It's not homonyms that turn out to be their opposite. They actually have to... They're arguably homonyms, but they have to be spelt the same way to be a true contronym. Another one is draw, like you draw a curtain. Does that mean open or close? The answer is yes. So if someone says, draw the curtain, and you don't know whether the curtain is open or closed, you don't know what they're supposed to do. Are they supposed to open the curtain or close it? Dust. You dust for fingerprints, which means you put dust on something. Or you dust by removing dust from something.
Thaw.
What?
Thaw.
How does thaw work?
Something can be thawed, but you can also take it out to let it melt. You would be thawing it.
Yeah, but in both cases, you
one
still want it to melt.
Freeze and one's to unfreeze.
No, thaw's never to freeze.
Something's thawing. It's just unfreezing.
Yeah, it's just unfreezing.
Okay.
But, no, that. Yeah. Anyhow, there are a bunch of them. Strain is close to a contronym. And that's what Pope wants. So soft as the strain is kind of not that soft. Because it doesn't just settle into place. You have to think for a second. And that causes a strain. You strain your brain. That's a good rhyme. Good. Thank you. But then it does, let's say, thaw as the s sounds. The hissing of the soft is the strain. Notice also the T sounds. Soft is the strain. When Zephyr gently blows. So now the S's are turning into the softer Z sounds, right? Do you think this is English teacher bullshit, or do you think this is really there? Okay, good, good. So soft is the strain when Zephyr gently blows. Notice that the line divides where? So remember, lines will have to divide conceptually by way of sound, by way of meter. Where would you divide this line into two parts? Yeah, does everyone agree?
Yes.
That it's soft is the strain when Zephyr gently blows. Notice what that does then is the first 40% of the line is the harder S, more of a strain, and then it resolves into a more languid when Zephyr gently blows. The S turns into a Z, and the more direct, pointed, punctual, soft as the strain, now becomes when Zephyr gently blows. And the smooth stream in smoother numbers flows. So what happens in the next line? Do a similar analysis to the next line. It's practically close to the same analysis, but do something similar. Where does the line divide?
Between stream and...
Yeah. So, and the smooth stream, that's the impacted first part of the line, and then what happens to that impacted part of the line? Soft is the strain and the smooth stream. What then happens?
Flows.
Yeah, even more smoothly. So the second half of the line flows more smoothly than the first half. And the smooth stream, that's like after great pain, you get those two stress syllables next to each other. And then those stresses next to each other, what prevents in the second part of the line, the last 6/10 of the line, what prevents having two stress syllables next to each other? What syllables are making that line go more smoothly? That part of the line go more smoothly. Well, what actual syllables? So smooth, stream, what happens to smooth? In the second half of the line.
It gets down to another syllable, so it becomes unsmooth. Like the first time you say smooth, it like rolls right off the tongue, and then when you add it smoother, it takes like longer, so it's less smooth.
Do you think it's, I think it is the herb, but do you think it's less smooth or do you think it's smoother? And the smooth stream, how smooth is that? And the smooth stream in smoother numbers flows. Which would you use to try to hypnotize someone? Now you are getting very sleepy. Just think, smooth stream. Or do you say, smoother, I'm exaggerating, but smoother numbers. If you're trying to get a baby to fall asleep, which would you say to the baby? Yeah. If you keep saying smooth stream to the baby, it's just going to go, eh. But if you say smoother numbers, this is a tip if you ever have to get a baby to fall asleep. Read it Pope, but read the second parts of the lines in Pope. So notice how the word stream is picking up from, what's it picking up from the previous line? By alliteration. Okay, so soft strain, smooth stream, those go together. And then in both cases, those are already supposed to indicate things that are soft or smooth. But to make the sound seem an echo of the sense, to the sense, you have to do more to the sound. So smooth stream in smoother numbers flows. So notice that you have the two ers, smoother numbers. It's not that they rhyme, it's that you're still getting a little bit of a hypnotic sense in the unstressed syllables. You're getting that repetition, smoother numbers flows. And you're still getting the Z sound at the end of flows the way we did at the end of blows, which is picking up from the Z in Zephyr. But when loud surges lash the sounding shore, so what's happening to the S sounds there? Yeah, and harsh sounding shore. Good word for it, lash. But when loud surges lash the sounding shore, the hoarse, rough verse should, like the torrent, roar. So here now we're getting all those stressed syllables in a row. The hoarse, rough verse should, like the torrent, roar. Then we looked at this before. When Ajax strives some rock's vast weight to throw, the line to labors and the verse moves slow, and the words move slow. Not so when swift Camilla scours the plain, flies o'er the unbending corn and skims along the mane. Anyone know who Camilla is? Camilla is a character in the Aeneid who battled against Aeneas and who was known for her speed. And this is almost a direct translation of a line of the Aeneid, how Camilla was so fast that she could run on top of the fields of grain. So here, this is what Virgil does. Not so when swift Camilla scours the plain, then the line doesn't labor, the words don't move slow, when she flies o'er the unbending corn and skims along the mane. So remember the Alexandrine, which was that like a wounded snake drags its slow length along? Which line do you think has more syllables? Would you intuitively think had more syllables if I didn't ask the question? That like a wounded snake drags its slow length along, or flies o'er the unbending corn and skims along the mane? Yeah, it feels like the needless Alexandrine would have more syllables, but if you count, no. But Camilla is so swift that he can just skim over all these syllables in flies o'er the unbending corn and skims along the mane. So it's got one more syllable, 13 syllables. But you just skim right over it. Okay, we can stop there with the Pope. But it's a really good example of someone who is getting you to look really hard at how the poem is self-describing, remember? And telling you something about how poems should produce their effects. The kinds of things poems should do to produce their effects. This is ultimately not that different from the Cummings poem about the whirling leaf, black against white sky, that one, where the way the words look, sound, feel is consonant with what it is those words are describing. There's a famous thing, I think it's way overquoted, but you may know it, that W.H. Auden supposedly said, he probably did say it, I don't know why I'm saying supposedly, that the most beautiful phrase in the English language, do people know what it is? Is cellar door. And that would be the opposite of this. That is, he's saying, as pure sound, nothing more beautiful than cellar door. But you can't not think of a cellar door then, and it's dirty and grubby and, you know, cobwebbed and so on. So it's not a great phrase to use in a poem if you're trying to do what Pope is trying to do, which is have the sound seem an echo to the sense. Then cellar door is probably not a great phrase to use in a poem. So that, in a way, is the opposite, the mirror image of what Pope is doing. Okay, I want to show you one other line. This is from Paradise Lost. Another line to indicate how the asymmetry of iambic pentameter works. This is Satan when he awakens on the burning lake and he sees his number two. Anyone remember his name?
I can't see
him. Oh, is it not?
Yeah.
Huh. Maybe we need green or purple. Okay. I mean, given that you've read Paradise Lost so many times, we should do at least one more line, right? Okay, that's better. Who's Satan number two? Anyone remember? Satan's the number two fallen angel. To whom?
Beelzebub.
Lord of the flies.
Yes. So he says to him, chained to the burning lake, awake, arise, or be forever fallen. So Milton doesn't rhyme. He doesn't end stop the way Pope does. He is writing in a way the exact opposite kind of iambic pentameter. But it's worth noticing this, that where does the line divide?
Arise and or.
Yeah, so we would say, this is sometimes called a caesura, by the way, just so you know what a line. It's different in Latin and Greek. What a caesura is different in Latin and Greek from what it is in English. So I'm just telling you how it's used in English poetry, which is differently from how it's used in Latin or Greek poetry. But it's basically where a line divides, where there's a necessary or important pause within a line. The word caesura, do people know why Caesar was called Caesar? Or why a caesarean section is called a caesarean section? So Caesar was born with a caesarean section, and the word Caesar comes to mean cut. So this is a cut in the line. It's awake, arise, or be forever fallen. So everyone agrees that that's where the line naturally divides. If you were an actor, you wouldn't say, awake, arise, or be forever fallen. It wouldn't go that way. It has to be awake, arise, or be forever fallen. Okay, so this is what Satan is saying to Beelzebub. And notice what he's saying is, be swift and active, awake, arise, powerful. Syllables. The most powerful stresses in the line are going to be wake and rise, not be or ebb or fall. Those have less stress. It's still perfect iambic pentameter. Da 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 da. But it's really da 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 da. So this is the part of the line that awakens, that arises. And then the alternative is just a little bit less active or powerful. Or be forever fallen. Becomes a little bit hypnotic. Or ever. Those things start threatening the fallen angels, not in vain, with
sleep.
Thank you. And this is the opposite of that. Awake, arise, or be forever fallen. So just another, you know, for Milton, it's intuitive. No one is thinking except us. Well, Pope was, obviously. But generally, poets aren't thinking, okay, how do I make this work? I know I'll have the stresses at the start of the line. It's just Milton wants to say, or have Satan say something powerful, and this is what comes into his mind. Milton called his verse unpremeditated. That is, that it's intuitive for him. What we are doing is a discursive exposition of what, for a poet like Milton, is intuitive. What we're trying to do is be explicit, partly in order to become sensitized to it. This isn't what you should now spend the rest of your life doing. But it is what, if you get sensitized to it, you will do naturally when you read poetry. The effects will be effects that you will absorb more readily, and the poetry will feel more powerful. So this is not, yes, whenever you read a poem, this is what you must do. It's rather, if you practice doing this, then you'll be able to do it intuitively. And it's a really good experience to have these intuitions. Okay, let's take a look at the Wyatt, at They Flee From Me. And as I say, Wyatt is probably the first great poet in modern English. We may, if we have time, look at a sonnet of his next week. Wyatt introduced the sonnet into English. That's another thing to know about him. Sonnets were essentially invented by Petrarch in Italy, and a lot of Wyatt's sonnets are adaptations, not quite translations, but adaptations of Petrarch's sonnets. So a sonnet, as you know, is a 14-line poem, and because it's 14 lines or 7 pairs of rhymes at most, there's going to be an asymmetry in how sonnets work. Again, just to tell you, this is since we've been talking about asymmetries, do people know the form of a Petrarchan sonnet? How it did? We talked about Shakespearean sonnets, which are 3 quatrains and a couplet. That's the asymmetry in a Shakespearean sonnet. Anyone know the asymmetry in a Petrarchan sonnet? How it's formed? So Petrarchan sonnet divides into an octet and a sestet. That is, into an 8-line section and a 6-line section, an octet and a sestet. The 8-line section will usually be rhymed something like A, B, B, A, A, B, B, A. That is to say, you'll have 4 A rhymes and 4 B rhymes in the first 8 lines. In a Shakespearean sonnet, it's going to be something like A, B, B, A, C, D, D, C, E, F, F, E, G, G. But in a Petrarchan sonnet, the lines will rhyme 4 times in the octet. Then in the move from the octet to the sestet, there's something called a volta. That's the word that English writers about sonnets also use, which means a turn. That is, the first 8 lines put you somewhere, and then there's a turn, a surprise, a reversal that occurs in line 9 and that gets you to the last 6 lines. So it was Wyatt who introduced this form into English, but he got it, as I say, from Petrarch. This is not a sonnet, They Flee From Me, but it's a poem of lament, and this is how Wyatt originally wrote it, not how Tottle in Tottle's Miscellany fixed it up to make it smoother, to make the rhymes better, and to ruin it. So partly I'm bringing in Wyatt here as a kind of opposite poet from Pope, because where Pope's rhymes are perfect, Wyatt's rhymes rarely are, or frequently are not, would be a better way to put it. Does someone want to read the first stanza, first 7 lines? Go for it.
They flee from me that sometime did me seek, with naked folk stalking in my chamber. I have seen them gentle, tame, and meek, that now we are wild and do not remember. That sometime they put themselves in danger to take bread at my hand, and now they range, Vasili seeking with a continual change.
Great, thank you. So Wyatt was an ambassador and a courtier to Henry VIII. And he was likely, although not certainly, a lover of Anne Boleyn's. And he actually saw her execution from a prison cell. Henry had him put into prison out of suspicion. Various things, and he saw her being executed. In a poem that he writes about that, he says, the bell tower showed me such sight as in my head sticks day and night. So what he tends to be, what his poems tend to be, are poems about, like lots of people, poems about erotic disaster, breakup poems, poems in which the person he loves doesn't love him or no longer loves him. But this is in a courtly milieu where it was expected that everyone would flirt with everyone else and that many people would have sex with many other people and that it was no big deal. That is, that if you had sex with someone, that was just part of the social world that you were in. No, don't have sex with anyone that Henry VIII is married to. That's a bad idea. He probably didn't. He probably had an affair with Anne Boleyn before Henry VIII fixed upon her. And when he did, that was a catastrophe for Wyatt because he seems to have loved her. People know about Anne Boleyn and how eventually, yeah, she got executed. So this is a poem about the erotic experience in court, but also something that seems to transcend that. But notice the first thing in the poem is the plural. They flee from me. Not she flees from me, but they flee from me. Who? Those that once sought him. They flee from me that sometime did me seek, with naked foot stalking in my chamber, as though he is their prey. They're stalking him in his chamber. Naked because naked also. That is, yeah, they've taken their shoes off. They're taking their socks off. They're in his chamber. I have seen them gentle, tame, and meek that now are wild and do not remember that sometimes they put themselves in danger to take bread at my hands. And now they range busily seeking with a continual change. So they're gone. This is sadness, regret, loss. But notice that he's not saying, look, I was true to one person, but they're looking, they're busily seeking for continual change. He's saying this is what we did. It used to be the case that lots of women wanted to sleep with me. And that was good. They took bread in my hands. They were gentle, tame, and meek. It was all lovely. But now they're looking for other men. And there's a hint of hypocrisy here, but only a hint. That is, I used to be part of this world where everyone slept with everyone else. But now I'm not. They're still sleeping with other people, but I'm somehow no longer part of it. But then in the second stanza, we don't have that much time, so I'll just go on. Then in the second stanza, things become more explicit. But before we quite get there, notice the rhymes here are seek, chamber, meek, remember, danger, range, and change. So how good are those rhymes? What does seek rhyme with?
Meek.
Okay, chamber?
Remember.
Yeah, not... Yeah, there's a kind of real off rhyme between chamber and danger, but the official rhyme is chamber and remember. And then danger, also rhyming there with remember and chamber, but seeming to rhyme maybe with range and change. So you might find yourself having to check what the rhyme scheme is here. So you would look at the second stanza. You'd see otherwise guys, that's like seek and meek. You would see special and fall and small, chamber to remember, special or special to fall and small. So that would indicate, yeah, it is rhyming A, B, B, C, C. Okay, does everyone see that? And you could then check yourself in the last stanza, waking, forsaking, gentleness, goodness, fangleness, served, deserved. So A, B, B, C, C. Okay, second stanza then. Thanked be fortune, it hath been otherwise. 20 times better, but once in special. So there were 20 different times where women sought me out and slept with me. But one time was really special. In thin array after a pleasant guise, that is, wearing a very, very thin sheer clothing in a pleasant way, in thin array after pleasant guise, when her loose gown from her shoulders did fall, and she caught me in her arms long and small. Therewithal sweetly did me kiss and softly said, dear heart, how like you this? So that's the memory. And we know it's the memory because of what he says in the next line. It was no dream. I lay broad waking. So it could have been a dream. It was so wonderful. But it wasn't. It was no dream. I lay broad waking. But all is turned through my gentleness into a strange fashion of forsaking. And I have leave to go of her goodness, and she also, to use newfangledness, she has leave to go elsewhere, to use newfangledness. But since that I so kindly am served, I would fain know what she hath deserved. Since I'm served with such kindness, I would like to know what she has deserved. So just a couple of points, which are points of meaning rather than of form, or somewhat points of meaning and somewhat not points of form, is where does the word gentle in the first stanza get picked up in the third stanza?
The end of the second word.
Yeah. So I have seen them gentle, tame, and meek. Now all is turned through my gentleness. So they were gentle, tame, and meek. And somehow he believed it. He believed that this wasn't just part of the social ritual of having sex with another member of the court, but he fell into true gentleness. But all's turned through my gentleness into a strange fashion of forsaking. Not strange for anyone else. That's just the fashion. That's what you do in court. That's the fashion of that court. But for him, it becomes strange. Strange is probably picking up on the word wild in the first stanza. That now are wild and do not remember that sometime they put themselves in danger. So wild and strange mean, they both mean the opposite of the ordinary or the domestic or the tame. So I have seen them gentle, tame, and meek that now are wild and do not remember that sometime they put themselves in danger. Line 20, this is just one of those words in English poetry you need to know. Poets used to really like the ambiguity in this word. It's something we don't spend much time on in 21st century poetry, but it was certainly a thing in 16th and 17th poetry, is the word kindly. So what does the word mean there? But since that I so kindly am served. What's the obvious meaning?
In a nice way.
In a nice way. And what's the tone in that case? Really kind of you there.
Like sarcastic.
Yeah, thanks for cutting me off. That was really kind. You saw that I was in a rush. Really kind of you to cut me off.
Good job, everyone.
Good job, everyone. Exactly. Yeah, so it's sarcastic. But there's another meaning of the word kind, and this is frequently you get the overlap. It's not quite a contronym, but close to one. So those of you who've read Hamlet, Claudius says to Hamlet, he finally turns to Hamlet. Hamlet has just been waiting around for Claudius to get to his situation, which is he wants to go back to school. He says, lockdown is over, I want to go back to school. sick of being at home with you, my disgusting stepfather, and my equally disgusting mother for marrying you. And he's waiting for Claudius to turn to his situation after dealing with all this other court business. And Claudius finally turns to him and says, "And now, my cousin Hamlet and my son," because he's his stepfather. And Hamlet's first line in the play, does anyone know it? He says, "A little more than kin and less than kind." So what he's saying is, you're calling me your cousin? I'm a little bit more than that. Oh, it just did that thing that it does. All right. It's reconnecting. All right, well, she'll deal. I'm a little bit more than just kin, but I'm not the same kind of person as you are. A little more than kin, don't just treat me as a cousin, but don't just say that I'm the same, that I'm your son as though I'm exactly the same kind of person you are, because hell no, I'm not. So the word kind there, do people know what kine means, K-I-N-E? So it refers to cattle. So they all have the same root. Kind means like when you say, you know, what kind of an asshole are you? You're so gentle. You're not saying you're a really nice asshole. Kind there doesn't have the same meaning as someone who is kind to someone else. What it means is the same genus. Like if you talk about humankind, you're not saying that humans are kind. You're saying it's a kind of animal, a kind of species. So kindly will often mean, this is what Hamlet means by it, it's also what Wyatt is also meaning by it, kindly will often mean treated according, well, you know it from Genesis, right? And then he had all the birds and the beasts according to their kind. So kind will often mean, yeah, predictably, given the species of being that you are. And the species of being that you are is an animal. We all are. They flee from me that sometime did me seek with naked foot stalking in my chamber. So the species of being you are is an animal. And of course, you treated me like the animal that you are, that we are. So the sarcasm is that you treated me with kindness. The non-sarcasm is you treated me according to the kind of sex-desiring physical beings that we were, rather than those who could feel love. And the mistake that I made was actually falling in love with you instead of understanding that this was animal passion that we were intent on. But what he remembers is this privileged moment. Therewithal she sweetly did me kiss and softly said, "Dear heart, how like you this?" And that for him is a magical memory. Dear heart, how like you this? And what he's done, what poems do, is, especially when they're quoting, we talked about this when we were looking at the ballads, and how speakers in ballads speak. When a poem quotes someone, when you remember, you write a poem about what someone once said to you, and it was just so beautiful what they said, and you frame it, you try to preserve its beauty by framing it in the beauty of the poetic form. That's the wonder that he's remembering here, that he's evoking. And I think that the strange rhymes that he uses here, and Wyatt always uses strange rhymes, I'll just tell you one interesting thing about him in 23 seconds, but the strange rhymes that he uses here, it's part of that evocation of strangeness. So you get chamber, remember, danger, or special, full, small, or even stranger, gentleness, goodness, fangledness. Those would not count as rhymes in modern poetry, but he wants them to be hard rhymes, to be rhymes about bewilderment. We're almost there. To be rhymes about bewilderment. So here's a really interesting thing about Wyatt, which is we know what he actually wrote rather than simply having it in Tottel's Miscellany, because his manuscripts were preserved but not published till the 20th century. And you can see him revising in his poetry. He writes a poem and then he revises it. So there are a lot of poems where we have Wyatt's revisions. And he revised towards worse rhymes, towards more imperfect rhymes. His first drafts were always more metrical and rhymed better than his revisions. So this is intentional on his part, which is a cool thing to do. This poem, the more you read it, the more haunted by it you will be. So, you know, give the 9 hours for this week, give it to this poem. Okay, see you all on Tuesday.